and remains to order. Open the public hearing on House Bill 5022. And we're going to begin this morning with Chancellor Joe Fox. I'll have you go ahead and we're going to put our staff at the end of the agenda. We have session at 10, so our time's a little compressed.
Well, that answers part of our question. We were deciding what to truncate and leave out.
Chairman and members of the committee, good morning. I'm Joe Cox, the Chancellor of the University System. I've been in this position since 1994 and in Oregon since 87. In front of you are binders which have all the hard copies of everything you're going to see on the screen, and I also am concerned about Senator Nelson being able to see that screen, so we provided you hard copies to do that. And what we'd like to talk with you about over the next 7, 8, 9 days is preparing the university system in Oregon for the 21st century so that we can be in the position to serve Oregon that we will need to be. And we will begin by sort of setting the scene a bit, and if you'll forgive me, because I know you've all seen these, but I just want to be certain that the context is there. And what we've done is to show you what's known as Joe's measles slide. It is infamous with Rotary Clubs and Chambers of Commerce. But basically, it's to make one point, that we are, in addition to the 7 campuses, we are in 146 different sites all across Oregon in every county. We serve, in addition to the 90,000 students that you all normally think of as college students, we serve another 100,000 students in evening and weekend and lifelong learning and continuing ed programs. We touch probably 250,000 Oregonians a year through the statewide public services from Oregon State University. So all in all, we touch every county and probably 500,000 Oregonians directly, not counting the indirect connections. And what I'd like to show you next is, you can't see it. This is known in the trade as the ski slope. It's slide number 3 in your book. And basically, all it does is it plots our percentage of the general fund since 1987, which happens just to be the year I came here. And it's the period that I've lived through and know intimately, and at least I know what occurred. And you can plot on this chart, you can plot the drop from about 12% of the general fund in 87 to 6.25 today. And our goal of this session is to gain back some of what that loss consisted of. And along that slope, you could plot, if you wanted to, measure 5 and 11 and 47 and the withdrawal of general fund. But the next slide is the one that I worry most about and shows you what's happened to tuition in that same time period. It's the other slope. It's the mountain climbing from the other direction. And it shows what's happened to resident Oregonian tuition in that same time period. So what we'd like to do for the next hour or so this morning is have you hear from the two people who have led, and I don't think it's inappropriate to say, the transformation, the reengineering, the recreation of the Oregon University system, based around 4 goals: expanding access, and access defined not just as finances, but also time and schedule; strengthening the quality of the program for teaching, research, and public service; achieving cost effectiveness so that we could say to our clients and our customers and their families, "You're getting the most we can for your resources," and finally concentrating on the employability of our graduates. The key to making this happen that you'll hear over and over again in the next 2 weeks is the recapitalization of the system to build back some of what we've lost. And to begin, I'd like to have you meet President of the Board, Tom Imason, from Pacific Corps. Mr. Imason is in his first term as President of the Board. He succeeded and worked with the gentleman you will hear second, Dr. Herb Ashkenazi from Albany, Oregon Freeze-Dry. And together, I think they really have to be, I'll embarrass them a bit, they really have to be credited with leading what I think is a very significant transformation of your university system. So if I may, Mr. Imason.
Thank you, Joe. Chair Minnis, members of the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee, I'm happy to be here this morning to talk with you about the future of Oregon's public university system. For the record, as Joe mentioned, I'm Tom Imeson. I'm president of the Board of Higher Education. The chancellor described Oregon's disinvestment in public universities throughout the 1990s and the subsequent increase in resident tuition during the same period. You'll see that in the slides that he provided with this material. But fiscal constraint is only one of the many challenges we are facing at this point in our history. So I'd like to outline some of the other challenges that the board is facing, and Herb and I will both point out how the university system is working to meet the challenges. I'll start with a brief overview of the fundamental changes underway in Oregon's economy, population, and delivery of educational services. And then Dr. Ashkenazi and I will briefly describe what we are doing to meet the challenges head-on, starting with the student-centered budget model we are implementing next fiscal year. Dr. Ashkenazi will take it from there, describing the reengineering underway beyond our enrollment-driven budget, reengineering that the governor and many of you and your colleagues in the legislature have helped us identify and to implement. If we do our jobs properly today, by the end of the presentation, we should make clear both the obstacles before us and the actions we are taking to overcome them. Our bottom line is this: we have succeeded in doing more with less since the decline in general fund revenue in the 1990s, but Oregon will need to expand its investment in higher education if our state is to fully achieve its potential. Looking first at the economic challenges, the state's emerging knowledge-based economy is one of the most important factors shaping the demand for higher education in Oregon. Except for the recent Asia-related slowdown, employment growth has stayed above the national average and is expected to stay that way into the next decade. But this projected job growth is linked to higher education. More than one out of every four new jobs to be added to the Oregon economy by 2006 will require a bachelor's degree or better. Examples of these high-growth occupations include mid- and senior-level managers, computer engineers and network administrators, health-related workers such as dental hygienists and medical assistants, and educators from preschool teachers on up. Oregon's natural resource economy will also be important. Although high technology jobs have outpaced timber-related employment since the middle of the 1990s, Oregon is likely to maintain its comparative advantage in the natural resources for some time to come. Moreover, new agricultural jobs are forming in the areas of biotechnology, environmental sciences, and food processing. These education-dependent jobs tend to provide good benefits and high wages. In fact, those full-time year-round workers with bachelor's degree or better are the only labor market participants in the U.S. whose purchasing power has held steady or increased over the last 20 years. The new economy also grants greater rewards to individuals with higher levels of education. Higher weekly earnings and lower levels of unemployment are correlated with advanced degree holders. But Oregon's high-growth employers will require more than just experts and technicians. Oregon's new economy will require workers to be creative and imaginative. These rapidly growing jobs will require critical thinkers who can work well in teams. Many of these problem-solving, think-for-yourself employees of Oregon's future are developing right now on the campuses of our university system. The critical thinking skills honed by a strong liberal arts education will also be an advantage to workers who are likely to make 3 to 5 major career changes during their lifetimes in this new economy. To stay competitive, businesses will rely on higher education for lifelong learning and for career development. Oregon's new economy will not just be about jobs. In an era when the memory capacity of a microprocessor doubles every 18 months, university-sponsored research will also be vital to our state's success. Oregonians have recognized this vital link between public universities and the Oregon economy. 92% indicated that a good higher education system in Oregon is vital if we are going to attract new businesses and industries to the state. 82% say the best way to get ahead today is to have a college degree. Turning to the demographic changes, Oregon's population will increase by almost 12% between 1997 and 2005. Oregon is expected to add 1 million people by 2015 and another 500,000 by 2025. Oregon's population is also becoming more ethnically and racially diverse. The fastest growth will be among the age groups 18 to 24, 45 to 64, and 85 and above. These demographic changes are reshaping the enrollment base at Oregon's public universities. Only a generation ago, campuses were primarily attended by traditional age students, 18 to 24 years old, living on or near campus. Today, a student may be an adult seeking a bachelor's degree at night while working during the day, or a student taking classes without seeking a degree. Just over 94,000 students enrolled in the OUS credit courses in 1997 and 98. 69,200 of these enrolled in regular campus programs, and over 25,000 enrolled in extended campus programs, including summer sessions. As the state's population becomes more diverse, so do the ranks of students in Oregon's public universities. Students of color gradually increased from 11.5% of the enrollment in fall of 1993 to 12.4% in the fall of 1998. As the number of Oregonians increases, so will the number of graduates from the state's high schools. Students admitted directly from Oregon community colleges form 16.5% of the undergraduate enrollment in the Oregon university system. Recent graduates from Oregon's high schools form 40% of the undergraduate enrollment in the Oregon university system. In 1996 and 97, the pool of graduates from Oregon's public and private high schools was 30,671. By 2007-2008, this pool is expected to expand to 36,207, an 18% increase. Oregon's strategic plan, Oregon Shines 2, calls for 33% of adult Oregonians to hold a bachelor's degree or better by the year 2000, and 45% by 2010. Only 29% of adult Oregonians have currently attained this level of education. In terms of the delivery of educational services, technology is providing greater choice and access, both in terms of schedule and geography, for students seeking higher education services, public or private. And for the first time ever, there is an international market for educational services, much of which can be delivered via cable television or the internet, whereby the learner can have what she or he needs on terms that she or he fits. The Oregon university system is at the confluence of these economic, demographic, and technological changes. With a good deal of help from you and your colleagues in the legislature, from the governor, and from countless business and community leaders throughout the state, we have begun a process of reengineering ourselves to better meet Oregon's needs. Dr. Ashkenazi will give you a more complete picture of our reengineering efforts in a moment, but I'd like to provide you with a brief overview of the central component in our efforts, which is our student-centered budget system. In the early 1980s, before much of the change Chancellor Cox and I have described took place, the university system adopted a budget allocation system known as the BAS model that pooled tuition revenue from the campuses with general fund dollars from the state. The revenue was then distributed among the campuses based upon a very complicated formula that emphasized institutional stability over fluctuations in enrollment or the state's labor market needs. In today's rapidly changing environment, the BAS approach has hindered the responsiveness of public universities to better serve the increasing and evolving demand for their services. BAS arguably rewards campuses that seek to maintain the status quo and punishes those taking an entrepreneurial approach to serving new markets. Next year, Oregon's public universities will have a student-driven budgeting system. Tuition dollars will stay on the campus that generates them. State funds will be allocated on a per-student basis with recognition for additional support needed for high-cost disciplines such as engineering, computer science, veterinary medicine, and pharmacy. This student-driven model is easier to understand, instructional costs are made more explicit, and campuses are simultaneously granted greater accountability for results and the autonomy they need to get those results. You will hear much more about the student-centered budget model in the next 2 days, so I will not go into greater detail now, but I would like to point out that the institutional presidents and their staffs from all 7 Oregon University System campuses have taken a collective leap forward in helping to develop and to implement this new budget model. And I'm sure I can speak for others on the Board of Higher Education when I say that their work in reengineering the Oregon University System budgeting system has been outstanding and is greatly appreciated. While I know that others will get into the budget numbers in more detail, I would like to provide just a little bit of context for the budget that has been sent to you. In working on the model, we were asked to and came up with the funds necessary for its full implementation, which would have been an additional $116 million for the biennium, including full implementation of the model and the tuition freeze. We were also asked by the governor to develop a number which represented what was necessary if to start the model if we were to phase it in over two biennia instead of one. And that is the amount of his budget. We think it's vital that we move ahead to begin to implement this new model as we have outlined and to provide funds that are necessary to get it started. That's the budget that has been sent to you. Obviously, we are happy to work with you in describing what can happen with various levels of funding, and that's some of the material that you'll be provided. Thanks very much. And I'd like to now turn to Herb unless you have any questions before we do that.
Any questions for Mr. Anderson? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom. Chair Minnis, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. For the record, I'm Herb Ashkenazi, and I am the immediate past president of the Oregon State Board of Higher Education and a member of the board. I also have a regular job at Oregon Freeze Dry, and I occasionally feel I need to mention that as a way of thanking the team down there for allowing me to spend as much time as I do up here. As Chancellor Cox and my colleague, Mr. Anderson, have pointed out, these fiscal, economic, demographic, and technological factors are converging in a manner that is truly revolutionary for public higher education in Oregon. Our efforts on the board, and my purpose in speaking with you today, to bring this convergence into sharp focus on the elements of this entire enterprise that matters most, namely the student. Educating students is at the core of what we do. Mr. Anderson has already given you an overview of our student-driven budget model, and you will hear a good deal more about that in the next couple of days. But I want to emphasize that there is more to our evolution than just money. The student-centered budget system is the centerpiece of a broad customer-focused effort within the Oregon University system. We are working to make everything we do in the classroom, in our research, in our statewide services, in our president's offices, and in our work on the Board of Higher Education, everything is becoming focused in one way or another on our basic purpose, to educate students. You can hear this charge in our mission statement. The Oregon University system is to both provide affordable access to high-quality post-secondary education for all qualified Oregonians. The system is to improve and enrich continuously the lives of the people in the state through the pursuit and application of ever deeper understanding. The system should infuse learning with the vigorous pursuit of free and open inquiry to assure that Oregon has the capacity to respond effectively to social, economic, and environmental challenges and opportunities. There's a nice ring to it, doesn't it? You've got to do things to make that kind of thing happen. Half a decade ago, as the decline in general fund revenue for the system continued, we started a critical examination of public higher education in Oregon. The Board of Higher Education commissioned an advisory panel of board members, legislators, and prominent civic and business leaders to examine the challenges and opportunities facing us and to explore a vision for meeting these challenges and opportunities. The advisory panel's report, which was called Education Unbounded, A Vision of Public Higher Education in the Year 2020, set in motion the extensive improvements you will hear about throughout the subcommittee's hearing this week. The 2010 advisory panel, while acknowledging the fiscal constraints of fewer general fund dollars, recognized the impending monumental increase in the demand for higher education services in the decades ahead. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that a bachelor's degree these days is the high school degree of a generation or two ago. Sticking to the status quo was clearly not an option. To meet the challenges that Chancellor Cox and Mr. Imeson have already discussed, the 2010 advisory panel envisions partnerships and seamless collaboration among K-12, community colleges, and higher education to expand options for learners. An entrepreneurial university system, highly responsive to its customers, and unfettered by undue regulation, but with this new flexibility, clear performance expectations between the state and the Oregon university system. A continuum of programs drawn from campuses working in collaboration with one another and with the community at large. And governance and structural changes that delegate strategic planning and monitoring of results to the board and operating decisions to the campuses. The 2010 advisory panel's vision and strategic framework provided an excellent starting place. The Board of Higher Education built upon this framework through a system-wide strategic planning process. The 1995 legislature concurred with a major component to this process when enacting Senate Bill 271, the Higher Education Administrative Efficiency Act. This legislation granted OUS the autonomy to conduct efficient personnel purchasing, contracting, and other day-to-day business functions. Just to remind you, what we promised to do was to educate more people without more money. And this was actually followed up by an auditing system, which the legislature set up and apparently worked, a step in the right direction. We've also been helped by educators, business leaders, and policymakers on two task forces appointed by the governor, the Task Force on College Access and the Task Force on Higher Education and the Economy. In addition, the business community guided us with their 1996 report, Gaining Competitive Advantage, the Need for Customer-Driven Higher Education. This effort culminated in the adoption of four mission-critical goals endorsed by the 1997 legislature in Senate Bill 919. Increasing access, improving quality, implementing cost-effective operations, and ensuring the employability of our graduates became the overarching objectives of the Oregon University system. We've also determined that it is not good enough to have just a goal. We had to make our progress measurable. Thus, the board also adopted 9 measurable performance indicators that correspond with these 4 goals. In March of last year, the board adopted the target-setting methods used by the Oregon Progress in establishing Oregon benchmarks. Oregon University System analyzed 10-year performance trends and data from peer states and institutions for benchmarking. The OUS campuses then set realistic yet challenging improvement goals for 2005 and are developing initiatives to improve performance. A more detailed description of our performance measurement efforts will be provided during tomorrow's hearing. But before I leave this topic, it is important to note that the practice of adopting measurable goals and holding us accountable for results does not stop at the campus level. Each Oregon University System president, the chancellor, and the board itself have all begun a process of setting measurable goals and evaluating performance based on our results. It has now been 6 years since the 2010 advisory panel was first convened. Much of the strategic framework has been accomplished, 10 years earlier than expected, I might add. Basically, we are focusing on seamless education, entrepreneurial approaches, performance expectations, continuum of programs, and governance changes. Oregonians have come to recognize our achievements. In 1993, just under half of Oregonians felt that higher education spent its tax dollars wisely. Today, nearly two-thirds of Oregonians feel that way. Not only that, but the vast majority, about 80%, says Oregon's public universities can and should be among the very best in the country. This is a high standard to meet, but with your help, I am confident we can fulfill their expectations. Now that I've proven I can read, let me take half a minute to give you some personal comments. Board has done some heavy lifting in recent years in an environment where I think that was required. We've changed things about how we spread out the money you give us. We've changed things about the level of autonomy the institutions have gotten, in return for which we expect them to be accountable for results. And importantly, we have tabled the idea that improvement is essential and develop measurable methods for seeing whether we are, in fact, getting better. I've been in public service in one way or another for a number of years, and I know, everybody who comes before you guys is going to ask for money, and we're no different. We're asking for money. What I would like to mention, however, is that we may be unusual, perhaps unique, in promising you specific results for that money. We've established baselines for performance. The institutions for whom this is pretty new stuff have been very cooperative. I submit to you that this is the kind of behavior which justifies encouragement from this committee. And with that, I will thank you, Chairman Ennis, and members of the committee, and be on my way.
Any questions? Representative Brown?
Thank you. Thank you for being here. And I do appreciate your long years of public service and your support for higher ed. As you point out in your testimony, we'd like to have a better coordinated, seamless system between K-12, community colleges, and higher ed. We in the legislature are faced with the fact that we don't have a big enough pie to do that for everyone and provide the money that you clearly have justified a need for in terms of moving to the new model. Do you feel that your colleagues in the business world are willing to join with us in securing new revenue so that we can fund adequately the three pieces of higher ed, of education, K-12, community colleges, and higher ed?
I'm not sure that anybody elected me to speak for the business world.
I'm just asking for your opinion. You don't have to sign any documents.
Well, I can tell you, for example, that Oregon Freeze Dry, which happens to be near Oregon State, where they do a lot of things we're interested in, is working and supporting some of the efforts of Oregon State financially, among other ways. And there's a metals initiative where people in that industry have come forward and contributed significant sums. I think broadly the answer is yes, but I don't think it's a substitute for public appropriations, right? Mm-hmm. Because it tends to be focused. We put money where our interests are.
Right.
You need to provide money for, art historians. Not a big industry there. And yet these people also are entitled to an education. I don't know if that answers your question directly. Yes and no, I guess, is the answer.
Thank you.
Thank you, and I appreciate your testimony today. I have a question about what's happening nationally. How does the 2010 recommendations and where higher ed is going, how is that hitting a trend nationally? What's happening in higher ed nationally? Maybe give us a perspective on that.
Well, I think there is more focus on results than there has been in the past because there seems never to be enough money for various kinds of activities. There are various states that have looked at even attacking things like tenure, asking for public institutions to provide more bang for a buck, so to speak. What is happening nationally, however, which applies to us, is that everyone, I think, is recognizing that the importance of making available to our citizens at least a bachelor's degree is going up. That's one thing. The cost of providing it is going up and has gone up over the years more than inflation, more than family income. This is a major league problem. And we are addressing it because one of the performance indicators, or one of the areas where we're focusing, is on cost effectiveness. We intend to use the money that you give us to improve quality, but also to reduce the cost for students. And this is to answer your question about national trends, this is a national trend. One of the major differences between us and most of the other public sector groups that will come before you is we have competition. You know, there are people out there. There's now a university, a virtual university called Jones International, an accredited degree-granting institution that gives bachelor's degrees on the Internet. That's just one kind of competition. There are lots of others. We need to get better for our own reasons, not just because we want to do a better job for the citizens, but they all come together in a way.
I might just add one word on the national side, if I might. With respect to the budget system and model, there's been a lot of national interest in what we're doing in Oregon. There is controversy sometimes over whether it's appropriate to have a budgeting system for higher education that is as clear as this one is. But it's receiving, I think we're taking some ideas that others have used, little bits and pieces around the country, and adapting them to Oregon, but I think in the main, with respect to how we're trying to budget, we're in a leadership position.
Thank you. I'm just wondering about the quality of the system. You've been observing it. As the general fund support has declined, what's that meant for quality, and what does this new mode of doing things mean for quality into the future?
That's a difficult one, Charles, as you probably realize. There are no objective measurements of institutional quality. And they won't be when we implement our new system.
Early on the board, you must have your perceptions of how we're doing.
Well, the way we're looking at it is we're saying that ultimately the quality of the system has something to do with the quality of the product. And we can measure the quality of the product. One of the performance indicators that is now being implemented has to do with what do our graduates know. And there are numbers of nationally normed tests, which in fact rank order the quality of graduates in a variety of fields. So the closest I think we can get to answering your question will be how good are our graduates? And that question I think we can answer. How that translates into the quality of institutions, we have some other measurements I think that are relevant. For example, the amount of research, external research funds that we bring into the state. It's an imperfect system. I think it's probably fair to say that the results of our declining share of the general fund haven't helped. But I don't think I can answer the question any more objectively than that.
Jonathan, do you have a view?
Well, I guess in some respects, I think Oregon has done a good job. I think I'd agree with her, but I think Oregon has done a good job trying to hang on to quality in the face of very difficult situation, especially in the post-ballot measure 5 era. And I think that's in part because of the way the system has responded, which is not to try to continue to do things the way they were done before that, but to try to adapt to what's necessary for the future. But I think all of us on the board have this feeling that we've been working to hang on to quality in the face of an adverse situation rather than making the efforts we ought to be making to actually improve the quality to meet the demands of the next generation.
Do you think the new model will enhance quality?
I think that it will, in part because I think people are. I frankly think in the old system, in the old model, it wasn't very. It was difficult to say, well, if you put money in, this is what comes out. And I think when you translate it to students, rather than just to funding institutions, and when you, what we've tried to do in the model is look at what peers. What programs cost, not just for here, but looking across the country at our peers, I think that enables legislative decision-making that ought to be able to link very directly to quality in a way that we haven't been able to before. Before, I think the idea was, well, if you put a little more in, we'll do a little better. If you take a little out, we'll do a little worse. I think that What we're trying to do is to say, here are the numbers of students that you can actually fund. Here are new initiatives that you may want to fund or may not want to fund, and do it on that basis instead of the more nebulous, we'll move it around to deal with any issue, but not do it in a way where I think the public is, it gets a very good idea of what its investment is all about.
Thank you very much, Natalie, and good morning, and thank you both for your dedication and your hard work. I'd like to get some more information on the Faculty Diversity Initiative, which I understand has been established by the Board of Higher Ed.
Yeah.
If you could speak specifically to why the board elected to put in place this initiative, but also what are the benchmarks? How will we know what's being achieved and when?
Senator Gourley, timing is everything, and at the board meeting on Friday, we will present the results of about 3 months worth of work in analyzing our efforts so far in achieving greater diversity, and I'll be happy to bring copies of that report tomorrow. You'll see it before the board will.
Excellent.
And I was quoted in the newspaper over the weekend as saying I was pleased by the progress we've made in diversifying our student bodies. I'm not satisfied with the progress we've made in diversifying our faculties and staff. And I think what you'll see in this report is that we are clearly, again, pioneering. As our scholarship program is the only one in the country which has survived court challenges. And I'm very, very pleased by that. But we'll be happy to bring that report, and you'll see it before the board will.
Great. And I'm understanding you'll bring it for the entire committee, and
yes,
have a chance to walk
you'll,
through
they'll
it.
They'll have that for you tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Hartung?
Thank you. Thanks to the three of you. And Herb, I sure agree with what you said about the competition. And I'd like to add one part to that. And I know you didn't have time to add all of it. But, we really made great strides, I believe, in strengthening the Oregon University system with the partnering, the collaboration that we did last session in Senate Bill 504. We took $5 million, and that has been multiplied, gave it to a private institution, OGI. And I know Joe, with his close work on which he understands, that was pretty unique, certainly unique amongst the 17 members of WICHE, but we must continue to pursue that. I mean, the partnering with Portland State, Oregon State, and University of Oregon on important issues, subject matter, the master's program in computer engineering, for instance. And I say we must continue to press in that area because Washington State University, with their junior-senior program over in Clark County, is becoming very aggressive. And I'm amazed, I'm pleased to see the way the state of Washington, the legislature, and the governor are really supporting higher ed, you know, to a greater extent than we are. For those where the competition is for this legislature to do that. And, you know, we can actually build on, for instance, Washington State's junior-senior programs in electrical engineering. They're probably better than or as good as ours. And so rather than have to duplicate those, we need to really follow through. And I know, Joe, that you really feel strongly about that arena.
Mr. Hartung, members of the committee, Mr. Amos and I just came back from a meeting in Seattle of all of the boards of 2,300 or 3,000 public and private institutions in this country that meet once a year. We're continually asked, how did you get three public universities to come together to do a joint master's degree in electrical engineering? And then I tell them, one of the partners is a private university. They're just absolutely amazed. I just need to correct one point for the record, Senator. The $5 million allocation went to create a virtual statewide college of engineering
in which Gordon Graduate Institute is a key partner. But not all $5 million. It was like it's a competitive process, and they budget together. It winds up being distributed involving OIT because they do the technical pieces, and but three public universities and one private university, and a common, jointly funded, jointly staffed, shared faculty enterprise. But that's the nature of where the world's going to be.
Thank you. I just wanted to pick up on something was asked earlier about the seamless education structure. I think, personally, and I think a lot of us would agree, that's the ideal. And of course, when we get in this building, we look at basically three separate structures. And when everybody comes and presents, they all present individually. What is it that you envision? How do you make that happen? How do you really break down the barriers between K-12, community college, and higher ed? Clearly, you're looking at that from a higher ed perspective of what you're doing. I would argue you need to be reaching down, particularly K-12, because that system, in my mind, is hurting rather dearly right now, and that will tap into the system. So I guess I'm trying to figure out how do we work more in cooperation. The governor wants to go out and try to find some additional funding for K-12. Quite frankly, that may be the wrong argument. It may need to be K-12, whatever, 16 or higher. So I guess I'd like some comment on that.
Well, just a couple of comments. One thing that we do as a board, and I think we're trying to do more of, is we actually work with the other pieces that you identified. We have a joint boards working group with the Board of Education and have joint meetings on occasion of the two boards. We've been working particularly closely in the community college area with joint proposals, especially on a regional basis. We have on working with K-12, the quality of the high school graduates has a huge impact on what the Oregon University system does, and we have been trying to work much more rather than much less, frankly, with them. You know, you can look at it on one hand and say, well, there are things in different boxes and we need to move the boxes. I think actually you'll always have some of those issues. What we need to do is try to make sure that the players involved are working more closely together. Our chancellor, I think, has already had several meetings and discussions with the new superintendent of public instruction. We've worked very closely with the community college commissioner, and I would expect all of those relationships to continue to be better in an attempt to have that kind of coordination. They are funded far differently, all of them, and that's probably why we end up coming in different ways. It's the nature of the state right now. But on the product side, I think we're trying to do a better job working more closely and coordinating better than we had before.
Particularly as the admissions standards change for us in the new PASS system that you will hear more about next week, that and its relationship to SIM and CAM is critical. If a higher percentage of our students can exit K-12 at the CAM level, and that changes the nature of our freshman year substantially in a positive, very positive direction. So we're very supportive and are working in every way that we can. We have staff who are involved with staff in the department head. Probably the best example of the collaboration are the partnerships in the regional areas, which you've already heard about. Roger and I were here last week, mm-hmm. and I'm very proud of those. And those, again, are unique. In different parts of the country, people are talking about doing it. We're doing it for you.
I think to some extent the increased emphasis on the student is moving in that direction. We've got a long way to go, but just to illustrate how far we've come, when I went on the board about 5 years ago, I was approached at a meeting by one of the faculty in our universities, and he said to me, you know what's happening? The community colleges are stealing all our students. We've got to stop them. I submit we've come a ways from there.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and very impressive group in front of us this morning. I think the last time you were in front of us at our education committee, I made the one comment, and I'd like to make it again this morning, as you talk partnerships and collaboration, and as you look at seamless education, would you please include for me P through 16?
Michelle.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I've been very impressed by hearing this presentation, but also community colleges at the collaborative efforts between the colleges, community colleges, higher ed, and K-12. It's exciting to see you guys reaching out to try to be innovative to capture the high school students, to get them on the college track and stay with them through the higher ed experience. So I'm very optimistic that we're on the right track.
We have some, I think, wonderful information to share with you later this week or early next on our efforts to influence the college decisions of the 3.75 or better students in our high school. And I'm very pleased by the fact that we turned that corner in a rather dramatic way. Pleased by the fact that Oregon graduating seniors are returning in great numbers. And we did a study last year that I would just share with you, even an analysis of the people who transfer to us. We hadn't done that before. 704 different institutions in this country sent us students. We were absolutely amazed at the fact that 44% of them had Oregon addresses, Oregon zip codes. These are obviously Oregonians who went away and have returned, have come back. They return. And we need to give them every reason to stay here in the first place, because all the statistics show that those who go away, go out of state to school, somewhere between 50 and 60% of them don't return to the state. So we need to keep our best and brightest and attract everybody else if we're going to be truly competitive. Thank you for listening this morning.
Thank you.
Oh, I was wondering, are we going to move Mr. Bender?
Yes, yes. Our illustrious staff has some information for you this morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We have distributed two pieces of information to you this morning. One is a document that looks like this that comes out of our analysis of the governor's budget. And what I've done is I've copied the portion on higher education for you that you hopefully would find useful to look at some point. And the other item is a handout that looks like this, that is a short presentation on the Department of Higher Education. The budget, or the funding for higher education, is primarily going to be funded through three bills this session. One bill is the bill that you have before you today, House Bill 5022, which will fund most of the operations of higher education. But there are two other bills that are floating around here that you should be aware of. One of them is House Bill 5021. House Bill 5021 finances the capital construction projects of higher education, the construction and renovation of facilities. And that is not the bill that you're looking at here today. And historically, that bill doesn't even come to the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means. Historically, it goes to a Capital Construction Committee of Ways and Means later on. So I wouldn't be surprised if that bill does not come before you this session.
Let's see. Would it be unusual if we requested that bill come through us?
I'm not aware of that having been done. That's typically the Capital Construction Subcommittee. Higher ed is such a large portion of the capital construction budget of the state that when they look at capital projects, that subcommittee, you know, typically likes to look at higher ed.
And, Madam Chairman, I would like to have a look at that bill if it could come here on its way to whatever committee it's normally referring to.
The other bill that is being used as a funding source for higher education this session is House Bill 5057. This bill is in the Natural Resources Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and this bill will fund the what are known as the statewide public services of higher ed. House Bill 5057. The statewides include the Agricultural Experiment Station, the Extension Service, and the Forest Research Laboratory, all three of which are housed with Oregon State University as the state's land-grant institution. That in the past has been included with this bill, but in this session, those particular functions will be financed through House Bill 5057.
Why, Madam Chair, why is that being handled differently?
I'm not sure we didn't get that one in this committee. It wasn't behind this draft, and I'm not sure what the rest of it
is. If we could get that information, sure, to understand.
Right.
Big picture.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, just a follow-up on that. The leadership in the Senate has been supporting the $100 million figure for higher ed.
Mm-hmm.
It is my understanding that that does not include the funding for 5057. Am I right about that, Steve?
That's my understanding, too.
Uh-huh. And so when we are looking at higher ed as a total, it would be higher than $100 million because it would include these other figures.
That's my understanding.
So, Madam Chair,
yes,
the short answer to Senator Gordley's question is they want more money and this is a good way to get it. I don't agree. I don't
think it's a good one. Better way to get it.
Right.
Madam Chair, there might be some Major 66 funds that are involved in that, too. The Major 66 funds, the parks.
I'm sorry, didn't hear
you. The natural resources.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Higher education is a very large enterprise. The budget for higher education is over $1 billion a year, and the governor is proposing a budget for the institution that would be $2.2 billion over the 99-01 biennium. Also, just to put things here in some perspective, higher education has, in a full-time equivalency basis, approximately 11,400 employees, which means that about one out of every four state employees actually work for the Department of Higher Education. In some sense, higher ed is different than the other budgets that you've looked at so far, the other big budgets, that is to say the K-12 budget, the community college budget.
Could we qualify that by saying we're not counting the public school people?
Right, that's what I was saying. Yeah.
And you say one out of four.
Well, the K-12 community college and OHSU, those employees are not state employees. And, traditionally, public education has been a local responsibility. Every community was required to establish schools, and those are local employees. Community colleges are similar. Communities that wanted to support community colleges were expected to establish them. And as you saw in the last budget, most of the state population now lives in areas that are in community college districts. But higher ed was never viewed as a local responsibility that a particular community was supposed to establish themselves. It has always been a statewide, or considered a statewide responsibility. So this is, the employees are state employees, and when you look at the budget, you'll see that there's sort of a mixture. In some cases, the legislature looks more or controls more the higher ed budget than in others. If you look at this document here, on the first page at the very top, which looks at the higher ed budget, you'll see there's a line there called non-limited. I wanted to explain what the non-limited funds refer to in this budget. Non-limited are funds that are, it's real money, it's money that the department is expected to spend, but these are funds that they're not state funds, and the legislature does not place a limit on how these monies are spent. What these monies include, and you can see there are $800 million of them expected, a large amount, are the following. First of all, there are some activities of higher ed that the state doesn't fund and that are in some sense off budget. Those include the dormitory activities, the self-support activities like dormitories, bookstores, health centers, cafeteria, food services, even parking. All of these are activities that the state is not involved in the financing of. Another major source of these non-limited funds are in the educational programs themselves, though, And these are funds that are received from gifts, but primarily from sponsored research. Most sponsored research is funded by the federal government. And to the extent that higher ed institutions and the faculty are able to secure sponsored research grants, that is outside of the budget. The legislature does not limit those funds. So those funds do become critical for supporting the activities of higher education. If you look at this other handout, which is where I'll be talking about from this point on, which is the one with the charts on it.
Okay, Madam Chair. Back up, Steve, a minute to the other funds. You listed the non-limited funds, and the other funds would be?
The other funds include other sources of revenue besides the state funds that are limited. The biggest component of that are the tuition and fee revenue.
Okay.
There are other components such as interest earnings and other items that come in there as well. And, in fact, even some of the sponsored fees come in there.
And this is a technical follow-up here. So what is basically the technical difference between the other funds and the non-limited funds?
The technical difference is that by placing a limitation on these other funds, the legislature looks at the overall expenditure. In essence, sets a target for how much funding is needed and looks at both the sources from the state in the form of general fund and the sources that come in the form of other funds. Whereas we're not really going to be talking about dormitories for the rest of this presentation unless you have specific questions, because that's not the way it's looked at.
Are there some federal funds in the other funds?
Yes, there are, Senator. All federal, the Department of Higher Education receives significant federal funds, primarily in the form of grants, but if for budgetary purposes, these are all considered other funds in this particular agency. About 20% of this total of $2.2 billion actually do come from the federal government, though.
How much?
20%. Or close to 20%.
That's some of us non-limited.
Yes, actually most of that is non-limited, but some of it is in other funds.
Question. Then federal funds could be in two categories, the other funds plus non-limited?
Exactly.
No distinctions when they start putting it in? I'm looking at the federal dollars now. In the non-limited, you said sponsored research grants. Could they also show up in other funds?
The sponsored research grants are divided into when a sponsored research grant is approved, what are approved are what are known as direct costs and indirect costs for a particular project. So if a professor or a group of faculty apply for a particular grant, they apply for funding to do a particular research project, and if they're successful, they receive compensation, both payment, both for their what's called the direct cost and then the indirect cost. The indirect costs involve overhead costs related to the research. And those indirect costs are actually split into the other funds, but the vast majority of the money, the great majority of the money of those types is in the non-limited portion. Looking at this other handout here, at the bottom of page one, the chart shows that approximately 7% of the state general fund lottery fund combined is used to support the Oregon University system in the governor's recommended budget. And if you look to page two of this handout, you see at the top that the governor's budget is supporting an increase for the Oregon University system of 16.6% in state funding over the prior biennium. And this is slightly higher than the overall average growth rate of the budget this biennium. And these numbers, all of these numbers, let me say, go back to the original governor's budget as he proposed it when the legislative session started these do not account for any changes that he has made, that he announced on Friday or earlier. The chart at the bottom of page 2 was a chart that was already shown when the chancellor was up, and that shows that the funding, the portion of the state budget that has gone to higher ed, and in this case I've combined Oregon University System and OHSU together because for historical purposes to go back to 89-91 when OHSU was a part of OUS, it's very difficult to separate them out. But you can see that there's been a decline, a substantial decline in the percentage of general fund that has gone to higher ed over this period of time. This, of course, is the Measure 5 period when the state was working very hard to meet its obligations to support the K-12 system as property taxes were falling and their growth was limited.
Representative Edwards?
And Steve, I agree with what you just said. I guess I might argue a little bit that there are other factors. Why there's been a distribution change, why things like more correctional facilities. I mean, there have been more demands than the budget.
Yes, that's correct. Page 3, the chart at the top of page 3 shows where the funds are coming from to support higher education. You can see that the state only supports about a third of higher education expenses. And you can see the other sources here. Tuition is about 17%. Federal funds, most of which are in the form of grant support, are about 19%. Sales and services would include sales and services such as the payments for dormitory fees and bookstores and that sort of thing, 13%. Donations and grants from sources other than the federal government are 5%. And then this catch-all category of other income, 13%, includes things such as bonds on COPs, interest, loan repayments, miscellaneous income, items of that nature. So the chart at the bottom of page 3 shows what total...
Just a question on the lottery. You say it was zero, and then when you look at your handout at the top of the page,
yes.
You've gone from $28 million down to $4
million. Yes.
What was it? I mean, you maybe explain why I'm zero, but also why was that drop from 95-97 to 28?
First of all, zero is a rounding error. It's not quite zero. There are still, and you know, I never even noticed that said zero until you just mentioned this, but there are about $5 million of lottery funds that are still in the higher education budget. All of these funds are the receipts from the sports action lottery game, which by law is dedicated to higher education, used primarily to support intercollegiate athletics, but a small portion of which is also used to support fellowships for graduate students. Prior, when you look at the earlier history, in 95, there was significant lottery support both for higher ed and other education programs. In 97, the governor proposed and the legislature agreed to essentially move the education programs off to general fund support. And all of the money was moved to general fund except for the sports action lottery, which statutorily is dedicated to higher ed. So it's just a rounding error where it comes down to zero.
And, Madam Chair, if I may, there is a bill in the Senate Trade and Economic Development Committee that deals with the sport action lottery, and I believe if it were to pass, it would have the effect of abolishing the sports action lottery dollars that go to higher ed. There are some folks who would like the state to be able to compete for the NCAA tournament, and because we have the sports action statute, that prohibits our competitiveness. That's one of the things we're hearing. I think I'm capturing this correctly. So this is a serious issue in terms of the dollars that currently go to scholarships and fellowships for some of Oregon's best and brightest, that would no longer be there if that measure were to pass.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At the bottom of page 3, you can see a history of the state support, state funding for what's known as education in general programs. This includes the statewide public services that are in House Bill 5057, as well as some other items of that the state supports, such as debt service and some goes into capital construction. But this is the basic state support for the educational program. By 1999-01, you can see it actually dropped in the Measure 5 period from $599 million to $503 million in 95-96. These are not adjusted for inflation. These are actual dollars. And there was an actual dollar decline since 95. There was an increase in 97 of about 13%, and the governor is proposing an additional 18% increase in 99-01 from the prior year.
Madam Chair, it would be interesting to see that chart adjusted for inflation. Could we do that?
Well,
or do we do it?
Sure. If you turn to page 4,
all right.
At the top,
there we go.
We adjusted for inflation.
There we go. Should have turned to page 4.
What you can see here is when you adjust those numbers for inflation, even with the increase that the governor is proposing, when you adjust for inflation, the number is still about 8% lower than the 89-91 funding level. So these are in $89.91 dollars, and you can see that there was a very large decline in purchasing power of the state funds that were appropriated to higher ed during this period of time. And this has been a very difficult situation to deal with, a decline of this magnitude.
And that insurance. Steve, what kind of figures are you using for inflation?
These are the CPI numbers.
Okay.
I'm sure.
Representative
Joseph? Just to get a better sense of what's happened in higher ed since, I guess, since the passage of Measure 5, rather than looking at actual these types of figures. We'll go back on page 3, the pie chart.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a variety of sources of income there. Can you maybe show us a pie chart that shows what that proportionality was, say, equivalent to 89-91? And then I guess I don't know how you'd show this, but that if you were to deflate those categories, and that obviously if you're pushing down general funds somewhere it's going up. Obviously tuition, federal funds have gone up. I mean, it give us a better picture. Obviously there's less dependency on state funds.
Sure.
But there may be greater dependency on other funds which have offset that 8%.
Tuition's gone up 90% in some places.
Right. But there are other things they've been driving for endowments and things that also help enhance funding, and I guess I'm trying to get us a better handle on how that works. I don't know what that would look like. I guess I'm trying to...
Representative Edwards, I can put that together. I don't have that here, but I do have some material that's not exactly what you're asking for, but sort of starts to get at what we're looking at. It's already here in this handout.
I guess, again, I'm just trying to get a better handle on it.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond the general fund, what else? Obviously, having the means to help themselves fund themselves and how that spread over the same time period. That's just the question.
I think that actually the... Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, I was just going to say... To get a fully rounded picture, you'd also have to see the 100 programs that were cut out of the budget.
Right.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
The chart at the bottom of page 4 shows a bit about what was happening or how higher ed and state adjusted to the situation or approached the situation of declining state funds. You can see in this chart, this again replicates the numbers for state funds. I'm not adjusting for inflation here. This is just the nominal dollars. But you can see that this repeats what you saw for state funds two charts ago. But on top of that, I've added the other funds, which are primarily the tuition. This is not the federal grants, but these are the limited other funds. And what has happened in a nutshell is that the state and the system have used increases in other funds to offset declines in the state funds. those other funds are primarily tuition. So tuition increases have been used over this period of time. If you look at the top line there, which starts a bit over 800 and goes up, that's the combination of the two sources. That's really the funding that's been generally available for the education programs of higher ed. And you see that over time, that has increased. And that's why we haven't seen, you know, there have been reductions in programs that have been mentioned, but you haven't seen institutions shutting down or what have you, which, you know, would have been difficult to avoid if there was not a way to keep the total funding increasing. But when you look at page 5 at the top there, this isn't the pie chart that Representative Edwards was asking for, but this does show, looking at the education portion of the budget, what proportion the state has supported of the total. And at the start, at the end of the 80s, the state supported about 65% of those costs. The remainder is essentially tuition. That declined to a low of 48%. It's about half and half this biennium, and the governor's recommendations would increase the state support portion to 54%. So there's some recovery that's going on there in the portion of the education costs that are being state-funded, though it's still significantly lower than it would have been at the end of the 80s. This increase in tuition that was relied on to keep the system going, you can see there at the bottom of page 5 how much those tuition costs have increased. Over the period shown on this chart, the tuition costs increased by 82%.
What was inflation at that time period?
If you look on page 6, at the top there.
Thank you. You're good.
This shows the undergraduate tuition rate adjusted for inflation. And there were significant increases in the early 90s here. But if you look at in recent years, this has been moderating, and indeed it's showing some decline in the last couple of years, because last biennium the state has funded a freeze of the for undergraduates of the instruction fee, which is the largest component of tuition. And because that's been held constant, when you adjust for inflation, there's actually been a small decline in the real tuition rate. So nonetheless, the 98-99 numbers is about 46% above 89-90, even after adjusting for CPI change.
You guess what I'm thinking there?
No. I don't have an idea.
I have a question. Can you show us what's happened to out-of-state tuition at the same time period? And again, what does Oregon... This is for in-state, I assume, obviously.
Yes.
What percent do they make up the student body of undergrad?
Well, that question I did anticipate. Not the first one, but the second one. I can get you information on the out-of-state tuitions, which are roughly, I think, a little over 10,000 a year now.
I think 10 and 12, okay.
But the chart at the bottom of page 6 looks at the enrollment patterns, and they do show both the total enrollment and then the resident or Oregon enrollment. The difference between the two is the out-of-state enrollment, which is shown as a separate line. I can do another chart for that. But if you look at the enrollment, over this period of time that we're looking at here, the size of the system has actually shrunk. It reached, on a headcount basis, enrollment reached a high at during for this period of 1991. Then there were declines that occurred in the early 90s. Certainly, the very large increases in tuition played a role in this. There were probably other factors as well. So it's never possible to totally explain what's happening with enrollments, but clearly the tuition costs had an impact on this. Enrollment continued to drop until the 94-95 year and has been recovering since then. The recovery rate has varied. In the 98-99, there was a 1% growth over the prior year. The year before that was a little more, you know, was more vigorous in growth. It was about a 1.8% growth rate. But still, if you look at the 98-99 headcount numbers, they're 2.5% lower than they were in 89-90. If you look at the number of Oregon residents who are attending higher ed institutions, the drop there was more precipitate, because what happened during this period of time was the efforts were made to attract more out-of-state students, because out-of-state students are paying tuitions that cover their costs of instruction plus some more. And the concept is, you know, this is a source of revenue that can then be used to offset the state general fund support and to provide the funds necessary to educate both the in-state and the out-of-state students.
I'm sure. And I think I would add to that also that we priced some Oregon students out of the state system by the raise of tuition. I don't know whether you want to agree with that or not, but that's my perception of what's happened.
Technical question. How long does it take? Can you get residency after a couple of years?
I mean, I think so. No.
They really work on me.
If you come to Oregon, let's say, help us rewrite this in 1990.
Did you come to the table?
For the record, Joe Fox. The legislature helped us rewrite this in 92. And if you come to Oregon to be a student, if your purpose in coming here is to be a student, you are a student for your 4 years. You can establish domicile. The rules are very specific, but you must come here to seek employment. You must be employed. You must be domiciled. Or you must be the dependent of an Oregonian who is domiciled, which is a legal address here. It's quite stiff.
Okay. Thank you.
The impact on, well, if you look at the resident counts by 95 were down over 12% from the start of this period, and they're still 6% below what they were in 89-90. In recent years, the resident count has been growing, and the non-resident numbers have actually been declining. So this is sort of a two-edged sword. In one sense, it's good, we're educating more Oregon students. In the other sense, the non-resident source of funding is not growing anymore, and that causes financial problems. The last two charts first show the projection for headcounts by the Oregon University System. They're showing projections that exceed the rate of growth that we've been experiencing recently. So in order for these projections to be realized, the institutions would have to increase the rate of growth in enrollment over what we've been experiencing recently. And the final chart outlines the enhancements in the governor's recommended budget to the Department of Education's budget. And there's a total there of $75.9 million in enhancements. You may also hear a $73 million figure bandied around, it's the same number. It's the same total funding, but there's some disagreement with some later as to what's in the current service level and what's not. But this represents about a 14.5% increase for the education and general budget above the CSL and a 22% increase over the prior biennium in state funding for higher ed. And the components, or what the governor's original recommendations were to split that money in the following manner: $44.7 million to implement the new budget model, $15.3 million to continue the freeze for undergraduate instruction fees for resident students, an $8 million package for engineering, computer science, and teacher training, $5 million for faculty recruitment and retention, and $2.9 million for classified employee salaries. Classified employees are primarily the non-faculty employees and support staff.
Madam Chair. Mayor Gordon. Oh, Mr. Bender, what are the assumptions behind the enrollment projection? How do we arrive at that?
The assumptions are that the portion of high school, Oregon high school graduates that will choose to attend a OUS institution will increase over what they have been, that the institutions will be more successful at retaining students that they already have, that they, the students will not drop out, and therefore that will increase the headcount as well. I cannot give you what all those assumptions are. I'll have to look into that and get back to you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you through those projections and how they're arrived. It's a mathematical analysis of demand, output from the high schools, our share of that group, and the fact that it's been increasing, the application admission activity going on right now. Mm-hmm. We put the history together with the current activity and we produced this projection. We're looking, we think, at possibly the biggest spike in Oregon undergraduate enrollment in quite some time. We'll have more data on that later.
That would be very helpful to me, Madam Chair, just in terms of wanting to have confidence in the projection. Understanding the assumptions that helps me do that.
Okay. Any other questions?
All right.
Are you finished? Well, we're adjourned for today.